as the silent seconds dance in their eternity about me and set aflame again the fire to inspire my nimble fingers to procure the pen and awaken it in a resurrection, transforming the ink to the blood of the writer. As once again he bleeds his acquired wisdom like a light into the world.
Good morning, Carbaro and the Big Chill. This is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else here at WCOM 103.5 FM. I'm in the studio with my co-host, John Paul.
Good morning.
He likes to say good morning, so I always leave him a moment. And I've asked Jerry Davis to join us again. So we're going to be burning coals with Jerry Davis of Burning Coal Theatre.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. In some respects, I have no idea what we're going to get into, but we're going to have fun with the show. I know John Paul is going to add his tidbits of the unmedia. I'm sure you've got something to talk about there.
I have a few little things I'd like to mention.
The unmedia being things that the rich don't want the rest of us to know, so we'll expose things that the newspapers don't. And in general, the speakeasy is pretty much for open conversation on any given topic. It is not confined to anything in particular. We do tend to do quite a bit with the arts because we're quite well associated there, but it's certainly open to anyone of any interest, and if you have an interest in coming on, please go to my website, which is www.claudioarts.com, claudioarts.com, and contact me through that, and I'll certainly consider making a show of it at some point.
It's also available by going to communityradio.coop and going to the iPod page, the podcast page, I should say. And you're linked on there, aren't you?
Indeed, yeah. Yeah, there is that. And at some point, I'll actually have that on my website. I haven't gotten up with my designer to further some of the things that I need to catch up on that end. I'm not a designer myself. We had Brian Krupp on, and he still does that.
Yes.
Low-fat designs. Anyway, floating over to Jerry, what's new with Burning Coal Theatre? How is that the new venue turning out for you?
It's been wonderful so far. We're in our second month in the space, and there are a few infant mortality issues that we're discovering.
Goodness.
For instance, we came in 2 mornings ago to find what was clearly the beginnings of a bird nest up in the rafters, and realized that somehow the contractors had failed to seal a hole in the near the roof, and that the birds who have been south for the winter are now back and looking for their home.
Oh Lord!
And a little closer, and so we had to bring someone in to silly putty the roof, I guess. And now the birds are all outside chirping away and wondering where the hell their home went.
So now the birds have to find a new venue now that Jerry's come in and taken over.
That's right. Well, we're hoping we can share the space with them, but it's been a wonderful space. We're in the last week of the second production that we presented in there, which is a gospel musical called Crowns by a young African American woman from Atlanta named Regina Taylor. And the play is just really beautiful and really inspiring, and is about the journey that a young black woman from Brooklyn, New York, goes on. She is the victim of a tragedy in her family, and is sent as a young girl south of the Mason-Dixon line to live with her grandmother. Mm-hmm. And it's about her reluctant acceptance of some of the community's mores that are quite different and quite in opposition to the lifestyle that she had been living, and it's quite beautiful, and it's packed with those great old gospel songs that so many of us grew up singing.
Mm-hmm.
And the people are the audience is which have been quite mixed in terms of ethnicity. So far, are just leaping to their feet at the
Wonderful.
End, and not to get out the door either, but to applaud the work of the artist. So we're really excited about it.
Kind of like going to church, huh?
That's right. That's the idea. That's exactly the idea.
Wonderful. How long has it been on?
We've run for 2 weeks now, and we have one more week through this Sunday, which is April 27th. We run Thursday through Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 2 p.m.
I wish I could have caught that. I noticed this weekend I'm working the Youth Tap, Ensemble. At Carolina Theatre, and last week we did Yeoman of the Guard with the Durham Savoyards, which is a wonderful, wonderful show, real spectacle. I love that bunch of cast and crew there. It's always a real sort of homey enterprise when we get together. We become a family for a week, and then it's goodbye.
It's always too short when you create a family in the arts. The other thing we did, speaking of families, Claudio, is that we just got back from London. We do a tour every other year. And we took 22 people with us this time.
Wow. And how, if you don't mind me asking you, how was that funded?
Well, the people who go on the tour pay for it. So it's a theater, theater seeing tour. We lead, take people around to other things as well, museums and walking tours and things like that. But the primary focus is on theater. And for the second time in a row, we solicit feedback at the end of the tour, and the overwhelming response was that the favorite thing about the tour was not any of those individual events, but the conversation about them that would take place the following morning at breakfast. We all gather in the hotel, dining area.
Nothing the English love more than a good chat, and they're very good at it, I might say.
And you pick up that real quick after landing at Heathrow.
That's why they do so well in pubs. They have things to talk about.
And why they do so well in the theater, because they then are able to put those things down on paper.
Absolutely.
And it's a wonderful experience to be in a city like London, which is not only so vibrant and bustling, but is fueled to a large degree by the arts. You turn a corner and there's a theater, and there's a play by Oscar Wilde running with a film star in the lead, I mean, we have that sporadically in the United States. But,
did you spend any time in Piccadilly Circus?
We spent quite a bit of time.
Any double-decker bus stories?
Yeah, we took a double-decker bus tour, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
A 2.5-hour tour, both the north and south of the Thames, and saw on the first day that we were there, and sort of acclimated the first-timers to the city. And
the common place of mystery stories over there, the Thames.
That's right.
Remember, what is it? Edgar Wallace was one of those famous authors. Every time a body was floating, it was floating in the Thames.
Right. That's
who did this now?
Right. And it's also the home of my personal favorite kind of an artistic mecca for me, which is the Royal Court Theatre in Sloane Square, which was the site of a very famous censorship case back in the late 1960s.
And what was that?
Well, there was the Royal Court. I'm going to back up just a little bit and tell you a little bit. The Royal Court was created in 1956. It actually was in existence long before that, but it had been a booking venue in the same way that, for instance, the Carolina Theater in Durham books in artists.
Sort of a historical theatrical
that's
premise.
Right. And in 1956, a man named George Devine brought a company in called the English Stage Company, and the first two plays that they presented were met with sort of a tepid response, both from the audience and from the critical press. But the third play and the last one, and sort of their last hope, was a play that when it opened again was not very received at first, but then Sunday of the first week, so after it had been running for 4 or 5 days and had gotten a series of kind of mediocre reviews, a man named Kenneth Tynan, who was a famous theater critic later in his life, he was a young man, then wrote an article for a thing called Second Thoughts on First Night, which was gave a second critic a
catchy
chance
title,
to go back and write. And it was in the Times of London. And Tynan ended the review with a phrase that went down in history. He said, "I do not believe that I could ever love anyone who doesn't love this play." And the play was looked back in anger.
Oh, goodness, of course.
by John Osborne, and Devine jumped out of bed after reading that review and started walking rapidly toward the Royal Court several blocks away. And as he neared the theater, he saw that there was a line of people out the door and around the block, and he began to run. Wow. And as he got closer, he noticed that they were young people. They were not traditional theater goers. They were biker jackets and denim, you know.
They'd actually broken some barriers.
That's right. And in it's my sort of fanciful idea that in that period of those few blocks that he covered there, that he changed the course of history by deciding to change the course of that theater. And the Royal Court Theater became a theater for new works.
Very likely. But it was shortly after that same time period you're talking about, it must have reigned in popularity for a while because Richard Burton put it to film.
That's correct. That is correct. And very shortly after that, Laurence Olivier. So
yes,
Laurence
exactly.
Olivier came to see Look Back in Anger to see what all the fuss was about. And when it was over, he went to this young writer John Osborne and said, "I want you to write something for me." And creating the famous headline, "The King Comes to the Court," which was shocking in those days. And Osborne wrote a play called The Entertainer.
Well, it's interesting, just to throw something in here for a minute, something theatrical. It's interesting how they referred to him as the king when he was alive, as far as theatre goes.
Right.
But then it was "Good night, sweet prince" when he died.
That's right.
What happened?
That's right. Well,
he was demoted
somehow.
Or he they remembered him.
They humbled him somewhat.
So then in jump forward a dozen years to 1968, I believe it was, the Royal Court was presenting a play called Saved by Edward Bond.
Mm-hmm.
And in England at that time, there was an official position of the censor. The Lord Chamberlain, Chamberlain's office was the official censor. And that office would look at a script before it was produced and declare, you know, you have to cut these words out, or you have to remove that scene, or you won't be able to do the play. And up to that point, the Royal Court had gotten around the Lord Chamberlain by, whenever he tried to censor something, they would simply turn their club into a quote-unquote private club, and they would charge a fee to be in this private club. But the fee was the same cost as a ticket was, so it was sort of a clever way of getting around this. But with Saved, they decided to challenge the Lord Chamberlain in court. Saved was a brutal play about declining morals among young people. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, it feels dated today, but it is a sort of a famous scene in it in which these youths stone to death a baby that they find left unattended on the street. And so it's quite a horrific scene, but it was not gratuitous in any way. It was meant to make this point about these declining values,
sure,
among a certain subset of society. And so the court challenged this and won. And very shortly after that, the Lord Chamberlain's office was abolished. It was clear at that point that there was no way that it was ever going to have any effect.
Interesting.
Again. And from that time, 1968, to the present, the Royal Court has presented the work of pretty much every significant writer that Britain has produced, as
mm-hmm.
well as the first English language adaptations or translations of works by people like Samuel Beckett, Waiting for Godot,
okay,
was
yeah,
first
yeah.
presented there. So it's a little known but very important building.
What a fascinating piece of history there. Well remembered by
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Certainly. Well, I don't know how many of those facts I got exactly right, but we're, you know, it's in the ballpark.
Yeah.
And it's a useful thing to remember as an artist, because Devine was not working to create wealth for himself. He was not working to create notoriety. He was not working to create a self-aggrandizing model. He was working to create a place where young artists could go and feel the freedom to fail.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And that has been their mantra for now 52 years, I guess.
Hmm.
What a remarkable thing. And wouldn't it be great if we had a place like that in the United States?
Well, aren't we working on that with Burning Coal? Yeah, I think we're evolving something there.
Inching in that direction.
Yeah.
Inching in that direction.
The one thing that I remember you and I discussed over coffee outside is that, of course, my uncle is retired now, but he was the executive chef of the London Hilton for more than 20 years and actually prepared and designed the wedding dinner for Prince Charles and Lady Diane. So I just thought I'd give him a little bit of a plug, but normally I would have been able to send you to him to say hello. And
that would have been
had
nice.
He not retired to Palier, France, which is where he lives now in his retirement years. He still consults, but he doesn't actively engage much anymore.
I could be persuaded to go to France as well if you...
Yes, easily, so could I. His name is actually Oswald Meyer, the former executive chef of the London Hilton. Quite a character. Uncle on my mother's side of the family. Anyway, let's bounce over here. A segue that John Paul didn't expect at all. Just wondering what we have on the Unmedia content aspect of the show.
Oh, my God.
Here he is, John Paul with the Unmedia.
Well, I just found this thing I thought would be interesting to listen to. Let's see if I've got this audio hooked up here right.
What was the true ideological nature of the 9/11 hijackers? Were they fundamentalists or mercenaries, prone to drug use in the company of prostitutes? Why were the Bukharis identified as hijackers on 9/11? But when one of them turned up alive on 9/12, why wasn't there a comprehensive review of the actual identities of the alleged hijackers?
Is that not a good question?
I would say so.
I mean, if you're the media and you release this list of people you claim hijacked these airplanes and flew them into buildings.
And are now obviously dead because they did it.
And, of course, they wouldn't survive that, even though the passport from one of them allegedly survived, floated down in nearly pristine condition to the ground near the World Trade Center and was found by, as you see me doing a little in quotes with my fingers, found by an FBI person or somebody.
You mean full-blooded Italian? Or
yeah, probably. So, you know, they put out this information. The FBI issued this list. The government issued this list. Okay, these are the hijackers. Okay, mm-hmm. Now you have this example we just heard about somebody who was found to be alive.
And not only did they have the names, they also had photographs.
They had photographs, and this is a photograph. Now, this isn't the only case in point with the supposed hijackers who have been found alive. BBC interviewed several of them themselves after 9/11.
Did he look a little dusty when they found him?
They never asked him that question. They didn't really get into that. I guess they were afraid that, you know, it would make somebody angry if, you know.
Just wondering if he was coughing a lot or in any way obvious.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean, you would think they would at least be dusty, yes. So anyway, let's go on and hear.
So
a little
back
more.
To this propaganda, not this propaganda, but the propaganda we've been being fed, and now the truth is actually coming out.
This is debunking the official 9/11 conspiracy theory, which people should realize that the official story put out by the government, the 9/11 Commission, the media
is the lie,
is the conspiracy theory, and it's absolutely the most ridiculous of all possible conspiracy theories.
It's called propaganda.
Yeah. So here we go. We'll continue with this little cut here.
If one of them turned up alive, couldn't others also be victims of identity theft aimed specifically at Arab pilots?
Yes. The answer to that is yes.
The derisive and arrogant dismissals of debunkers do not calm the waters that are troubled by Griffin's sober observations and suggestions. The host of contradictions examined in this book leave the reader with the unsettling thought patterns about the nature of the Bush administration.
The book he's talking about is the latest book by David Ray Griffin, who is a theologian and studies, I can't remember exact terminology, but he studies information systems to see how they really work.
To see what the resources are.
And he's on the faculty of Claremont Theological School. So he's a bigwig in academia. And he's the one who very, very early on started writing about things that didn't make sense to him in the 9/11 narrative.
I don't see how it can make sense to anyone personally.
Well, yeah, it really doesn't. So
anyone with a brain, that is.
The name of his book is 9/11 Contradictions. And I highly recommend anyone reading anything that David Ray Griffin has written about 9/11. He's an extremely meticulous researcher and lays things out very logically.
Do you mind if I ask what sort of conclusions he draws?
His conclusions are that we have not been told the truth about what really happened on 9/11.
For what purpose?
Well, it's not part of his purview to determine those answers necessarily. He says that in order to get those answers, you first got to realize that we weren't told the truth and begin a real investigation into what actually happened. He says that the 9/11 Commission was just a completely bogus whitewash operation.
Something to pacify the public.
There are something like 113 points that he and some of the surviving families of 9/11 victims make about the what's wrong with the 9/11 Commission. Now, his first big book was 9/11 Commission Distortion and Omissions, in which he outlined some of the more obvious ones, and then he got deeper and deeper into it over the years, and now this is his latest offering, which goes into more detail about what really happened.
I think it's an interesting idea, but it seems more likely to me that if we're talking about confusion of a person's identity, that human error could simply be the problem, as opposed to some sort of massive conspiracy to blame the Saudi Arabians for this.
Right, but if in fact it was just a simple matter of human error,
right,
why wouldn't they immediately go into correction mode and
make a public apology for one thing,
and then correct what they obviously had wrong? Now, it's not just one person.
No.
There are at least six hijackers, right, who have been found alive and then have been interviewed.
Supposed hijackers.
So let me play devil's advocate and ask you another question.
And
if I'm no defender of our current administration or frankly any in recent memory.
I thought they were your buddies.
But no.
No, I'm just
kidding. We play a game of pickup ball every once in a while.
They're no friend to any of us.
Yeah,
George Bush has no game. Okay,
no,
he's shoot the ball
outside of 12 feet. Forget it.
He's got it.
But the question would be if this were some sort of a fabrication, why would they have picked the identities of Saudi Arabians when Saudi Arabia is one of the closest allies of our current administration? Why wouldn't they have picked Iranians or Libyans or somebody that they wanted to go attack, or Iraqis for that
good
matter?
Point.
I think probably because that is who they had in their stable of potential, persons of interest, shall we say.
Mm.
And they used these identities because they were simply handy. That you got to remember, these people are not too bright.
Uh-huh.
Okay? They're not really bright. They all the time you see examples of how really ridiculously stupid they were.
They didn't really make room in any of their judgments for any of this to surface.
Yeah, and the facts that if you look at them carefully, all along, you'll see how just about everything they did with relation to 9/11 was just really stupid. For one, you claim that these certain people did the hijacking and flew these planes when all the information from every other quarter shows you very clearly that these people could not possibly have operated these planes in the manner in which they were operated.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not possible. They were not, for instance, one of the hijackers, Hani Hanjour, supposed hijackers, was claimed to have flown one of the planes into the building. He went like a few weeks before 9/11 to a small airport, civil aviation airport, and wanted to rent a small single engine plane. So the people at who rented the plane said, fine, we'll take you up and test you so we know you can fly the plane. That's a requirement. And if you pass the test, we'll let you rent the plane. So they take him up with their ace teacher pilot. And when you get back down on the ground, the ace teacher pilot gets out of the plane with his knees shaking. And he says, this guy cannot fly a simple Piper Cub. He is horrible. I will not verify his capability for renting the plane. They would not rent him the plane because he was such a terrible pilot mm-hmm. that the guy just feared for his life while this guy was at the controls.
Sure.
Okay, so now this is the guy that's going to do one of the most impossible maneuvers there is to fly a plane into a building. Flying a plane into a building is not like driving a car down the road and hitting something that you want to hit.
No, you've got wind turbulence for one thing.
It's completely different. Mm-hmm. It takes tremendous skill. Beyond anyone's imagination, the amount of skill it takes. For an example, there's a pilot who teaches people to fly major commercial airliners, 737s, 57s, 67s, 77s. This guy teaches these. When he saw the stuff on 9/11, he looked at it and he said, wow, I can't believe somebody was actually able to hit those buildings with mm-hmm. those planes. Something's not right about that. Mm-hmm. So
on the first pass in both cases.
Yeah, yes. On the first pass. So he had a stable of students that he was working with. He took 10 of them. Who were his best students, who were nearly through with their flight training. Mm-hmm. So they were very familiar with the operation of these large commercial airliners, 757s. He put a simulation up for them in the simulator, New York City. He said, hit the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. He gave each one of them 10 tries. Not one of them was able to hit the trade centers in 10 tries. Mm-hmm. These guys were far more skilled than any of the supposed hijackers. He then went himself. Now, this is a pilot with 30-something years of experience flying commercial airliners. Mm-hmm. He goes, and he tries to hit the building. He could not hit the building in 9 tries. Finally, on the 10th try, he was able to hit the building. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, was able to adjust and
altitude.
fix his... Well, he had practices. He had 9 right. practices. Right. But it took him 9 practices to hit the World yeah. Trade Center.
Yeah. Well, unless you're coming in for a landing, those planes aren't meant to fly that low.
At that speed, at high speed, near the ground, it's very difficult to put something on a dime. Mm-hmm. All right? So, the point is, obviously, that it's just not credible to suggest that these almost completely inexperienced
rookies,
ne'er-do-well people who every instructor they had, each one of them, every one of their instructors said they were horrible pilots. They could not fly. So the idea that these guys maneuvered planes into buildings or into the Pentagon, it's just ridiculous.
There's extended footage.
Cannot have happened.
There's extended footage on this in the documentary Loose Change, and I'm sure you have another one to recommend.
9/11 Mysteries also talks about
9/11 Mysteries. Pick those up.
All the books that really look critically at the information we've gotten from the 9/11 Commission and other sources go to this point and make the point that it's just not credible. You just can't be serious when you're talking about somebody really inexperienced actually being able to hit a building with a commercial airliner.
Fascinating.
More things to consider.
Now, beyond all that, if you just look at one factor of 9/11, which was the collapse of Building 7, which happened at 5:20 or right around 5:20.
And which contained?
In the evening, which contained all kinds of FBI files, CIA files, SEC files, had all the stuff in there on the Enron case that they were supposed to be prosecuting.
I mean, and much government information.
Lots of stuff that the government, this current government, does not want anybody to ever get a hold of. But that, notwithstanding all that, if you look at the collapse of the building, there is no doubt. There is absolutely no doubt. The building was brought down by controlled demolition. You've got the world-renowned experts in controlled demolition saying so, 100% certain. Watching the video of the building collapse, this guy named Danny Jovenko, who is a guy from the Netherlands who's been doing controlled demolition for 30 years, who's one of the foremost experts in the field throughout the world, he watches the video of the collapse, and he turns to a guy and says, the guy who's showing him the video, and says, that was controlled demolition.
Mm-hmm. And you can see footage of that.
And you can see footage of it on the web. You can just Google Building 7 demolition, and you'll get it. And you'll probably get the link to Danny Juenko's interview where he talks about this. The guy who's interviewing him showed him this video, and after Danny Juenko said, well, that was controlled demolition, I'm 100% certain. I've destroyed dozens and dozens of buildings. I know what I'm talking about. That was controlled demolition. It was done by a team of experts.
Otherwise, it'll take down 20 buildings next to it.
And it was a very good job. And he explains in very briefly how controlled demolition works and why that video he saw was a controlled demolition. All right. So, I'm just going to play a little bit more of this. But with the Danny Juenko testimony, and there's others, too, who are controlled demolition experts who have said, you know, that was controlled demolition. So you got to know that building was brought down by controlled demolition. That changes everything. You can no longer believe the 9/11 official story if you admit that Building 7 was brought down with controlled demolition. Because it takes weeks, at least, if you have a huge crew, takes less than a week maybe, but you still have many days of work to place explosives in a building like that and have them timed correctly and all that. So it was brought down by controlled demolition. There is absolutely no doubt.
Okay, so
that
give us the rest
everything.
Of it.
Okay, so here we go. Back to the review on 9/11 contradictions.
And then pass it back to me.
And then pass it back to Claudio.
Indeed.
And who was calling the shots that day? Why do the accounts of Norman Mineta and Richard Clark, which are clear, lucid accounts, so starkly contrast with the official accounts of that day? Why does Shaney contradict himself?
Dramatic pause.
Why do debunkers have so much time to dedicate to discrediting the questions of the 9/11 skeptics, when the object of their wrath should surely be the 9/11 Commission report? Not since the Warren Commission has such an obvious and blatant cover-up been hoisted on the American people and the world, and the debunkers troll the internet for straw men to tear apart. So
there you go. That's enough for now. So I recommend anybody reading the David Ray Griffin work. Another author who has written a lot about this subject is Stephen Jones. He's a professor of physics for decades at Brigham Young University. He was head of the physics department there. He began to be curious about this when somebody who he knew came up to him and said, "Well, why can't you see that 9/11? There's something funny about 9/11." And what happened was that he said, "Okay, I'll look into it." He didn't believe what this guy was saying, that the official story was not correct. So he started looking into it, and after a few weeks of research, he began to see that things just didn't add up. And he's a physicist. So what did he do? He went and got materials from the residue of the collapse, including pieces of steel. And he tested them. He tested them and found residue from explosive. He's found actual pieces of thermite in the residue, which is the explosive that's used when you do building demolitions. So read Stephen Jones, read David Ray Griffin, and you'll start to get some of the most compelling testimony of what's going on. That's just my voicemail telling me. Okay.
So and pick up Blue Stage. You want to do something about that voicemail there?
So anyway, there you have it, Unmedia.
Okay, good. I'm glad he finally passed that ball back. I want to read something that a buddy of mine, who was also my backup musician in St. Thomas, emailed to me, and I thought this was a pretty fascinating take on political correctness. The following is the 2007 winning entry from an annual contest in Texas A&M University calling for the most appropriate definition of a contemporary term. This year's term was political correctness, and the winner wrote, "Political correctness is a doctrine fostered by a delusional, illogical minority and rabidly promoted by an unscrupulous mainstream media, which holds forth the proposition that it is entirely possible to pick up a turd by the clean end." I couldn't resist that one.
I challenge anyone in the listening audience to do that.
Indeed.
Pick up a turd by the clean end.
And then smell your fingers.
Yes.
We'll take it from there. Now, here's something from a fella that I really have very little regard for, but I actually thought he made a statement worth hearing, and it's kind of ironic that a statement like this should come from him. His name is Lee Iacocca, the man who rescued Chrysler Corporation from its death throes. He has a new book out, apparently. And here are some excerpts. This was sent to me by Ira David Wood. And again, I'm not a friend of those that enrich themselves on the labors of the people. But I just thought that this was a statement worth conveying, and it's ironic that it should come from one of the rich. Am I the only guy in this country who's fed up with what's happening? Where the hell is our outrage? We should be screaming bloody murder. We've got a gang of clueless bozos steering our ship of state right over a cliff. We've got corporate gangsters stealing us blind, and we can't even clean up after a hurricane, much less build a hybrid car. But instead of getting mad, everyone sits around and nods their heads when their politicians say, stay the course. Stay the course. You've got to be kidding. This is America, not the damn Titanic. I'll give you a soundbite. Throw all the bums out. You might think I'm getting senile, that I've gone off my rocker, and maybe I have. But someone has to speak up. I hardly recognize this country anymore. The most famous business leaders are not the innovators, but the guys in handcuffs. While we're fiddling in Iraq, the Middle East is burning, and nobody seems to know what to do. And the press is waving pom-poms instead of asking hard questions. That's not the promise of America, that my parents and yours traveled across the ocean for. I've had enough. How about you? I'll go a step further. You can't call yourself a patriot if you're not outraged. This is a fight I'm ready and willing to have. The biggest C is crisis. Leaders are made, not born. Leadership is forged in times of crisis. It's easy to sit there with your feet up on the desk and talk theory, or send someone else's kids off to war when you've never seen a battlefield yourself, i.e. George Bush. It's another thing to lead when your world comes tumbling down. On September 11th, 2001, we needed a strong leader more than any other time in our history. We needed a steady hand to guide us out of the ashes, a hell of a mess. So here's where we stand. We're immersed in a bloody war with no plan for winning and no plan for leaving. We're running the biggest deficit in the history of the country. We're losing the manufacturing edge to Asia while our once great companies are getting slaughtered by healthcare costs. Gas prices are skyrocketing and nobody in power has a coherent energy policy. Our schools are in trouble. Our borders are like sieves. The middle class is being squeezed every which way. These are times that cry out for leadership. But when you look around, you've got to ask, where have all the leaders gone? Where are the curious, creative communicators? Where are the people of character, courage, conviction, omnipotence, and common sense? I may be a sucker for alliteration, but I think you get the point.
That's good.
Name me a leader who has a better idea for homeland security than making us take off our shoes in airports and throw away our shampoo. We've spent billions of dollars building a huge new bureaucracy, and all we know how to do is react to things that have already happened. Name one leader who emerged from the crisis of Hurricane Katrina. Congress has yet to spend a single day evaluating the response to the hurricane or demanding accountability for the decisions that were made in the crucial hours after the storm. Everyone's hunkering down, fingers crossed, hoping it doesn't happen again. Now that's just crazy. Storms happen. Deal with it. Make a plan. Figure out what you're going to do next time. Name me an industry leader who is thinking creatively about how we can restore our competitive edge in manufacturing. Who would have believed that there could ever be a time when the big three refer to Japanese car companies? How did this happen? And more important, what are we going to do about it? Name me a government leader who can articulate a plan for paying down the debt, or solving the energy crisis, or managing the healthcare problem. The silence is deafening. But these are the crises that are eating away at our country and milking the middle class dry. I have news for the gang in Congress. We didn't elect you to sit on your asses and do nothing and remain silent while our democracy is being hijacked and our greatness is being replaced with mediocrity. What is everybody so afraid of? That some bonehead on Fox News will call them a name? Give me a break. Why don't you guys show some spine for a change? Had enough? Hey, I'm not trying to be the voice of gloom and doom here. I'm trying to light a fire. I'm speaking out because I have hope, and I believe in America. In my lifetime, I've had the privilege of living through some of America's greatest moments. I've also experienced some of our worst crises. The Great Depression, World War II, the Korean War, the Kennedy assassination, the Vietnam War, the 1970s oil crisis, and the struggles of recent years, culminating with 9/11. If I've learned one thing, it's this. You don't get anywhere by standing on the sidelines waiting for someone else to take action. whether it's building a better car or building a better future for our children, we all have a role to play. That's the challenge I'm raising in this book. It's a call to action for people who, like me, believe in America. It's not too late, but it's getting pretty close. So let's take off the crap and go to work. Let's tell them all we've had enough. Fire the bastards.
Good one.
Anyway, that sort of hit a chord with me. I've been thinking of writing something along those lines myself. Never thought I'd be quoting Iacocca, one of the rich himself, but I just think it's an ironic twist that it should be one of them that actually says, look at this absolute rubbish we're submerged in.
Yeah, that was very good. It's too bad he didn't start talking like that 20 years ago.
Yeah.
When really the same sorts of things were going on.
When he was in a position to do it,
exactly.
These things that he talks about, and I think he's right, are not brand new. They've been going on for at least 150 years.
Oh, absolutely.
Years. I date it back to the time of the Mexican-American War, which I think was the real turning point in the decision of U.S. leaders to become imperial.
And we've never had a government in this country without corruption.
That has not existed. Well, it doesn't exist anywhere. Without corruption. But
Such nobility exists. But anyway, I want to turn it back to our friend Jerry Davis, whom we've sort of had sitting in the seat here for a minute. Of course, he's had some valuable input, but I want to find out more about what's going on with Burning Coal Theater and what you got lined up, what's coming up. This is your spot to promote. So the mic is yours.
As I mentioned earlier, we're finishing up this gospel musical Crowns, which is a very beautiful and inspiring piece of work, and it runs through this Sunday, the 27th. We have just announced our season for the 08-09 year for the coming year. And speaking of radical politics, we're going to open the season with an American premiere of a play by David Edgar, who is among the most left-leaning radical playwrights of the 1960s and 70s. He's known in this country for an adaptation he did of Nicholas Nickleby, Charles Dickens book that ran on Broadway, won the Tony Award and all that stuff. But he's quite a politically engaged writer. Even today, he just turned 60, and he's giving us the American premiere of a play of his called A Prisoner's Dilemma, which is a play about conflict resolution, and it's part of a trilogy of plays that also includes Pentecost, which we produced last February, and a lot of people in the area saw and really liked. And so we're excited about this. It was produced at the Royal Shakespeare Company back in 2003 and has not been produced in the United States yet. So, and David's going to come and work with us on it.
So it's a premiere. You say David who?
David Edgar, the playwright.
I see, okay. Wonderful.
He's flying across the pond, as they say.
Fantastic.
To join us for a week of rehearsal at the beginning, and then he'll come back again at the end of the rehearsal process and be with us the week we open the
play. Well, let me know if there's any chance I'm listening in, even if I come over there and do a bit of an interview.
I'm sure that would be possible. I'm sure it'd be possible. And he's got quite a few ideas about global politics.
Hmm. Wouldn't it be fun to have him on the
radio show here? It would be incredible
to have him on,
especially both of you.
Yeah. Well, that would be nice.
And David is a brilliant and a kind man. You know, he's very thoughtful and considerate, and so he doesn't much care about. You know, I keep going back to this term, self-aggrandizement.
It's a good term.
Because of the political climate that we're in right now,
it's pretty much all they do, isn't it? Self-aggrandizement.
Well, it certainly seems that way. And I to stray off the theatrical thread just for a moment, I think to some degree we have to blame our media for that. In order for leadership to sink to the level at which it currently finds itself,
to be so bought out,
right? We have to redefine it, right, in our minds. We as the citizens and the mechanism for redefining. redefining leadership is the media, is the mass media. And so when we talk about when Iacocca talks about the deafening silence that he
where is the outrage
hears right now, the outrage, what he's really saying is that the cameras are not focused on the outrage and that the microphones are not pointed in the direction of the outrage. And
to a great extent that's true, but I don't think there's enough of it anyway.
Likely, yeah.
It would bleed through if there was.
Right, that's right. I think what happened in the 60s, quite frankly, is that the media had become a thing that didn't know what its own power was at that point, and mm-hmm. we didn't know, we meaning the culture, didn't know how to control it, and so served to spur on outrage and to spur on political activeness. And now we find our media just as edited, as censored, as any other aspect of our life. So anyway, I'm not sure that the arts are the entire answer to that sort of thing. But one of my
certainly a good one.
One of my fanciful little ideas is that the theater is a place that the reason the theater continues to survive 4,000 years after it originally began, and I dare say that General Motors might not exist that long, Mr. Iacocca. But the theater has existed because it remains the place where individuals, you and I and our neighbor and the person we don't know down the street, can all gather in one room to consider the great ideas of our time. When you go to see a movie, you sit in the dark by yourself.
Essentially.
Now, there are other people there, but you're not aware of them and you're not focused on them. But when you go to the theater, you are aware of, if it's an interesting theater, mm-hmm. and a well-designed theater, then you're aware of the people around you as well as the people on the stage, and you're aware that there really is no disconnect between those.
And the
two.
Whole idea is to stimulate interaction anyway.
I think so. Interaction of thought,
at least on the subject.
Right. That's right. That's right. And so, so we hope that at Burning Cold, that we're providing a place where people can come and think about those things, and that will lead to the expression of outrage or civil disobedience.
Absolutely.
Right.
Very necessary in this time.
And one of the things I'm proud of is that we have people. You know, we do a pay what you can day at each performance where mm-hmm. people come in who might not otherwise be able to afford tickets. And
you and Peggy seem to have that in common, Peggy Taphorn of
right,
Temple Theater.
Right.
In Sanford.
And but we also have many of the politicians, you know, because we're in the state's capital, we have a kind of access to those people, and so representatives and senators and people, the mayors and city council people, county commissioners, they all show up in our audiences, and they're all sitting there with these people that they are there to represent, you know, all together in a room, and that there's a kind of political forward thinkingness about mm-hmm. that suggests that your idea is just as good as mine if we're in that same room together.
Absolutely.
Listening to the same play and considering it. And so it's a valuable tool, I hope, for society, and the David Edgar play is going to be a very exciting event for us. We're going to do a farce after that.
Which one?
It's a relatively new play called Hysteria by a British writer named Terry Johnson. It's the funniest play I've read in the last 15 years or so. It's just fall out of your chair funny, and it's very serious, too. It's all of our work tends to in that direction.
Yeah.
We'll do Twelfth Night by Shakespeare in December. In January, we're going to do a play by a Spanish playwright, Juan Mayorga is his name. He's one of the hot young up-and-coming Spanish.
Yes.
And we're going to do it in Spanish and English on alternating performances.
Interesting.
So we'll hire a bilingual cast,
wow.
a bilingual director. And it's a play called Way to Heaven.
That's a rather brave premise there.
Well, we're gonna stick our toe in the water and see what it feels like.
Peggy's going to do that similar thing, didn't she say?
I think she mentioned something along those lines,
yeah,
being bilingual.
That's a great great idea, uh-huh. I think.
Well, we keep hearing about these communities that exist around us, and we don't ever come in contact with them, and the only way to do that is to dive right in and mm-hmm. see what happens.
Well, if you're ever going German, I can speak that, sir.
Okay, very good. That community we have a little more access to.
I know.
And then we're going to close the season with a new play about the civil rights movement, and particularly the portion of it that took place in the building that we're performing in now, the Murphy School Auditorium. For those of you who don't know, the Murphy School was the place where the Raleigh City School Board met in 1960 and voted to begin the desegregation process in Raleigh City schools.
Yes, yes. Now, I think it's fascinating that you've got that place.
Yeah. And so we're writing a play about it. We've gone out into the community and interviewed people who are still around from that time mm-hmm. period, people who lived through it, people whose lives
Wonderful.
Were impacted.
What a great idea.
And we're going to put their stories on stage. There's some amazing... do you have time for one short
sure.
short story?
Sure. I think we do.
A young man named Joe Holt, who's not young anymore, but at the time his family was trying to get him into the school system. He was in middle school, I think, when they first started, and they failed repeatedly all the way up to the Supreme Court. They were turned back and told, you didn't do this, or you didn't sign that form right, or you know, something, you should have shown up at this committee meeting. But Joe said that his family's picture was on the front page of the News and Observer one day. And for you or I, that would be, you know, an extraordinary day in
sure,
our
it
lives,
would be, yes.
and a memorable day. Well, for them, for his family, it felt like they were there was a sense of terror,
being disgraced
and
somehow,
of dread in their house. It was unspoken, but there was a sense of dread about it that he wondered about, and a quietness in mm-hmm. the house. And when he was in his 30s, you know, years and years later, he finally realized what had caused that sense of dread, and it was that up until that point in Raleigh, North Carolina, in mm-hmm. my hometown, if a black person had their photograph on the front page of the newspaper, it was because they'd murdered someone.
Oh, good Lord.
And otherwise, they simply did not have their photograph on the front page of the paper. That kind of story is compelling and dramatic, and it's worth hanging on to. It's worth hanging on to those things. So we're going to put it on the stage, and we're going to start a dialogue.
Any idea what you're calling this?
1960.
1960, and that's the title.
That's it.
Yep. Wonderful.
Neat.
Yep.
Neat.
Fantastic. Give us a rundown one more time of everything you've got coming up, as well as contact information for Burning Coal Theatre.
Okay.
And this is Jerry Davis speaking, who is the founder and director at Burning Coal Theatre.
Well, our website is burningcoal.org. Our phone number is 834-4001. We're running a gospel musical called Crowns through this Sunday, April 27th. It's a beautiful piece of work about a young African-American woman who's sent to live with her grandmother in the South and finds and gets a little more than she bargained for when she comes there.
I'll bet.
And then we're in the fall. We'll open the season, our first full season, in the what's now called Memandi Theater at the Murphy School Auditorium, thanks to a generous
There's
contribution.
There's another Memandi?
Well, no, it's the same Memandi.
Oh, all right.
But he's proving to the community that he's interested not just in the big, splashy things, but in the...
Progress Energy setup. For one.
That's right, but also in the what we think of as R&D, research and development, which is what Burning Coal is. And so, Dr. Memandi has given us some money, and we are very delighted to have his name on our building.
Certainly
now.
Pleased to hear that.
And we'll open with David Edgar's "The Prisoner's Dilemma" on September 11th.
And please remember him to the speakeasy.
It's a deal.
Good. So, any more final notes here? We can. We've got Touchstones coming up with Paul, who's going to be in next. I think he's already in the studio. If we want to cut out a little early today and give him some time to get himself adjusted, or do you have any other meat on the bones there, John Paul?
Oh, well, there's lots of stuff we could talk about.
Don't start another political thing here. We've had enough.
Well,
all you got to do is look out the window.
I don't think we have had enough. I think
we'll beat them up a little every week, not all at once. How's that?
They need to be beat to a pulp and shoved out the door is what they need.
Give them a big boot.
Yeah, one of my big things is that these people need to be charged with the crimes.
With the crimes they are
committed.
They are.
They need
committed.
To be indicted.
Amen.
Prosecuted, tried, convicted, and my idea for a good sentence is that they have to spend the rest of their lives in jail without the possibility
and,
of parole.
And clean out these idiots that call themselves a Congress because they're a joke.
Well, most of them are complicit with what went on in 9/11 and with the Iraq situation.
Absolutely.
And Afghanistan. And so, you know, it all kind of all melts together and you begin to realize that...
And you get this thing that you can pick up on
rotten.
The clean end.
Yeah.
Right?
It's fishy as hell and... We need to do something about it.
So anyway, on that note, I think we're going to sign off at the speakeasy. Jerry, I want you to know it's been a real pleasure having you on.
Thank you.
I'll probably call on you again at some point.
I will be back
keep
as soon as you do.
Good. Wonderful. And John Paul, thank you again for co-hosting.
A little early, but off
this
we go.
This is Claudio at the speakeasy, the literary and all else. Bidding you cheers.
Once again, a chill night wind blows its gales across the sea. As the sunset casts an inflamed and rippled hue across the waters. Vast distances of liquid motion stretch their infinity before me. And I have rarely felt so free. The sails are drawn for a night of rest. Where I go from here, the sea knows best. As the veils of night descend upon me, the moon emits its silvery canvas against a spectacle of aquatic celebration, as is only seen by night. The stars are scattered worlds of light against an opaque sky, and the nightfall is a constant whisper of the mysteries around me. Truly, all description would defy the beauty I choose herein to proclaim. Yet still, though encompassed by more wonder than many a man has e'er freed his soul to admire, my thoughts are adrift with a song of my heart, and a song of my heart with a voice of my soul. Adrift, 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 drifting ever back to you.